Every morning, my inbox heaves with a new tranche of email alerts from Nextdoor, a social networking service for neighborhoods where people in the local area post recommendations, inquiries, requests, offers, information. The tone can be chummy, jocular, kindly, anxious, but mostly the posts are angry. They include vituperative warnings about dodgy tradesmen, outraged reports of cruelty to animals witnessed by neighbours, snatches of grainy Ring camera footage purporting to show actual or attempted burglaries, complaints of junkies splayed on park benches, and of predatory lone men approaching young girls, reports of vandalism, fly-tipping, charity muggers, phone scammers, poor restaurant service, and late-night noise. My heart sinks at each new set of notifications festooned with rage emojis and opprobrium for low-life scum, animals. Yet I've never been tempted to unsubscribe, and not only because the service is also a surprising showcase for human generosity and solidarity, reuniting desperate owners with their cats and wallets, offering help and advice to the hungry and infirm. Much as I appreciate these outbreaks of decency and kindness, it's the transmissions of rage that draw me to the posts. A batch of Nextdoor updates is a live window on the vexations of modern urban living, an electric chorus of sighs, growls and screams from the front line of everyday reality. I'm not on any other social media platform, largely because I suspect they would ruin my life. I imagine being sucked down one or other virtual rabbit hole and remaining there indefinitely. On Twitter, now X, even upbeat sentiments like self-satisfaction, mutual affirmation and sincerity seem to have a tinge of anger about them, a subtext of inquiry as to why you haven't yet noticed the poster's unique wit and integrity, their fine creative output or charitable contributions or cookery skills. The endearingly human anger on Nextdoor is lacking on X, characterized by its tones of righteous indignation and caustic sarcasm, high-handed contempt and gleeful cruelty. The times that I have looked at it, the trolling, shaming and piling on, show it as a zone of freeform hate. The social media giants promote the grandiose illusion that your smartphone is a global megaphone, blasting out your furious convictions on the social, ethical and geopolitical dilemmas of the moment to a potential audience of millions, even if your actual followers number in the low hundreds. It cultivates a mode of anger that is both impersonal and self-important, a style of sloganizing that is grindingly repetitive, each post an echo of the last. Nextdoor posts, in contrast, will reach and likely interest only those in your own neighbourhood, meaning there is less incentive to engage in performative provocation. The poorly styled, typo-ridden posts are genuine effusions of feeling, the sounds emitted by rubbing against the grain of life. Posters speak of wanting to vomit, to scream, to cry, to punch their antagonists. They remind us that anger, like all significant feelings, is experienced first of all at a bodily level, as a pressure towards a discharge through the mouth or limbs. Perhaps this is why these posts sometimes evoke for me a kind of makeshift psychoanalytic session. In my consulting room, one of the most common beginnings for a session is a launch by a patient into a full-throated rant against some individual, a teenage son, say, or haughty barista. Institution, a national bank or local gym, or situation, an unjust parking ticket or global heating. In moments like this, clinical psychoanalysis reveals itself less as a communication between speakers as between bodies. A raging patient will often induce in me mirror symptoms, contracted muscles, accelerated heart rate, grinding teeth, fluttering stomach, as I become not merely aware of their anger but possessed by it, experiencing the same overpowering congestion of bodily and psychic faculties, the same incapacity to think or feel anything but the object of their fury. In their very different ways, Nextdoor and a psychoanalytic consulting room offer a depository for dissatisfaction, a space in which to voice the frustrations of living in a world that forever fails to give us what we want. Perhaps this gives us a clue about the nature of anger. We often associate, and sometimes even confuse, anger with aggression. But aggression, unlike anger, belongs to the domain of action. It is the effort to exert dominance over or hostility to some object outside oneself. Aggression can be channeled into hair-pulling, mockery, or playing minor chords on a bass guitar, but it always manifests in the external world. Anger, on the other hand, while it can certainly make itself perceptible to others, is first of all a feeling, a phenomenon of the mind and body. Unlike aggression, anger can be concealed from the world and even from oneself. One of the most frequent and unsettling discoveries a person can make in psychoanalysis is just how much anger they're harboring towards others in their past or present without having been aware of it. We have a habit of thinking of anger and aggression in the terms Frank Sinatra speaks of love and marriage, a perfect couple in which one serves the other so seamlessly that you can barely tell them apart. Anger comes to be seen as aggression's head cheerleader, an agitating voice feeding the aggressive impulse with motive and impetus to act. In The Expression of the Emotions in Man and Animals, Darwin argues that our common forms of emotional expression are vestiges of the actions they once accompanied, as when we mime the act of retching to express disgust. In anger, he observes, the impeded flow of blood can turn the face purple or white. Our breathing becomes laboured, our teeth clench, our limbs may tremble, gestures that represent more or less plainly the act of striking or fighting with an enemy. On the one hand, this evolutionary perspective points to the Sinatran intimacy of anger and aggression. To be angry is to assume the physical attitude of a predator. But Darwin's theory equally implies that the angry stance is a kind of trace or relic of aggression, that while the link between the two once seemed organic and necessary, evolution has rendered it looser. An angry face may or may not anticipate an aggressive action. Anger, in other words, lives a life quite apart from aggression, and aggression is only one of the ways we can express it. We can equally keep anger quietly to ourselves, turn it in on ourselves, disguise it as sullenness, over-politeness, or jocular teasing, or repress it to the point where we ourselves don't even know we're angry. Each of these options raises the question of how I'm to live with my angry self, especially in a world so forbiddingly dense with angry selves. For at least the last decade, and perhaps especially since 2016, with its flashpoints of Donald Trump's election victory and the vote for Brexit, anger has felt like the defining colour and tone of our daily social and political lives, giving rise to a pervasive atmosphere of mutual fear, suspicion, and accusation, in which any perception of difference – cultural, ideological, racial, sexual, class – shades quickly into the assumption of enmity. This public mood has seeped into our private lives and relationships. At the most immediate level, we can point to the well-documented divisions and resentments that Trump, Brexit, COVID restrictions, and so many other markers of cultural and political alignment have insinuated into the lives of families, friends, couples, and communities. In my consulting room, irritable talk of these visible sources of division runs alongside more elusive emanations of anger, perceptible in one person's clipped diction and flared nostrils, in another's stiff, tightly guarded comportment on the couch, and still another's coiled withholding silence. In short, I found myself living in the shadow of the so-called age of rage at every level of daily life, from the news headlines blasting out of my phone and TV, to the feeling on the streets around me, to the intimate space of the analytic session. Writing this book has been a way of making sense of this experience, of thinking through how and why anger drives us, both in the universal experience of being human and in our own agitated moment. Any psychoanalyst's consulting room is a crucible of anger. Anger is often directly expressed, but I also see it pressing through under the cover of some other emotion, sadness perhaps, or anxiety, or love. This clinical ubiquity has often led me to wonder why psychoanalytic literature has so little to say about anger. Sigmund Freud, founder of psychoanalysis, was more concerned with aggression, which he viewed as central to the life of what he calls the drives, enigmatic entities situated on the border between mental and physical life that impel us to satisfy our various needs and appetites. The drives are the region of psychoanalytic theory which Freud revised more than any other. In among numerous modifications and tweaks, there are two major iterations of drive theory. In the first iteration, Freud categorized the drives into a sexual drive and a self-preservative or narcissistic drive. He later considered that they consisted of a life drive, directed towards the growth and expansion of the self, and a death drive, directed towards self-erasure and unbound aggression. Spurned and doubted by his followers at first, and still controversial today, the death drive became one of the most famous of all Freud's ideas. A drive is different from an emotion because its ultimate aim is to act rather than feel. While the impulse to love at the heart of the life drive, for example, makes itself felt at a bodily and emotional level, that feeling's primary purpose is as a spur to attain love in the external world. By analogy, we might say anger is what we feel, in technical language the affect, and aggression is what we do about it, the drive. These two levels of experience, feeling and action, affect and drive, are connected, of course. But Freud says little about how. The one exception is in a curious paper from 1914, The Moses of Michelangelo. One of its oddities is that Freud chose to publish it anonymously in Imago, a journal founded by two of his disciples exploring various fields of cultural and social life from a psychoanalytic perspective. Written in the guise of a submission by an amateur art enthusiast, the paper explores the question of what kind of relationship exists between anger and aggression, feeling and action. It begins by surveying various art historical essays on Michelangelo's great sculpture, Moses, in Rome's San Pietro Church. Each of the essays attempts to decipher the peculiar ambiguity of Moses' gait and expression as he sits with the tablets of the Ten Commandments and comes to quite different conclusions. Among these conflicting opinions, however, Freud finds one point of consensus, the idea that Moses' gaze is caught in the grip of an infinite wrath in which the next instant will launch his great frame into violent action. Moses is captured, in this reading of the sculpture, at the moment he has caught sight of the idolatrous revels of the Israelites before the golden calf, his body agitated with the imminence of his action, which will be to spring up, raise the tablets just received from God on Mount Sinai, and hurl them to the ground in fury. This reading of the sculpture implies a seamless passage of the drive, the aggressive impulse caught mid-flow on the way to its full consummation in the action of smashing the tablets. The implied role of anger is as a kind of midwife to the aggressive drive, the feeling that spurs and impels the act. Moses' infinite wrath, with its imminent realization in the sublimely violent reproach to his people, is a model of the ideal harmony of feeling and drive, based on the subordination of one to the other. But the psychoanalytic conception of human drives implies a different and more complex relationship between feeling and drive. The distinction made by neuroscientist and philosopher Antonio Damasio between feelings and emotions may be helpful here. Damasio's definition of emotion follows that of Darwin as the way an organism instinctively seeks to ensure its own preservation without conscious knowledge of the undertaking. Emotions are effectively stimulus responses to a given object or event. I see a dangerous dog off its leash and I cower in fear. I smell roasting meat and I'm possessed by the irresistible urge to devour it or perhaps to vomit. But feelings involve mapping these reactions to produce internal images of and ideas about them. Feelings creatively process what emotions react to automatically, facilitating the possibility of creating novel, non-stereotypical responses. Anger, in this perspective, is of a higher order than aggression, a transformation of reactive behaviour into a kind of self-reflection. Feeling comes after drive, not before it. Damasio provides a fascinating illustration of this thesis from clinical research at the Salpêtre Psychiatric Hospital in Paris, in the story of a 65-year-old woman with Parkinson's whose symptoms were relieved by electrode contact with the affected parts of her brain. On one occasion, the electric current passed through a contact site just below the usual area. The patient very suddenly assumed an expression of sadness and began sobbing uncontrollably. A few seconds passed, and she spoke of how she could no longer go on living this way and wished fervently to die. The researchers immediately stopped the current, and the sobbing stopped as abruptly as it had begun. Her behaviour returned to normal, and she wondered good-humouredly what all that had been about. Damasio's explanation was that the current had missed the general motor structures it was intended to reach, and instead made contact with brainstem nuclei that normally control action, including movements of facial musculature such as frowning and sobbing. His point is that these neural reactions occurred without any prior triggering thoughts of sadness, indicating that emotion, in the form of stereotype gestures such as crying, comes before feeling. Emotion-related thoughts came only after the emotion began. In a paper from 1971, the American psychoanalyst Hans Löwald offers a strikingly similar conception of feeling as belonging to a higher level of psychic function than emotion. In its most primitive form, a drive is a means to discharge instinctual energy by way of some action in the physical world. Human development involves the transformation of drives into psychic phenomena, that is, into feelings rather than programmed behaviours. This transformation is also a key aim of clinical psychoanalysis. For example, a patient might bring an incoherent unconscious aggression to the beginning of an analysis, which in the course of a treatment would become anger, both felt and expressed. In his ingenious reading of Michelangelo's monumental sculpture, Freud tracks exactly this transformation. He suggests that Michelangelo would have been aware of apparent anomalies of sequence in the biblical text. For example, in Exodus chapter 7, verse 8, Moses intercedes for the idolaters with God after God tells him about the calf. And yet, 10 verses later, Moses appears to know nothing about the calf and is suddenly aroused to wrath when told. Michelangelo, Freud suggests, has mined these sequential inconsistencies to create a new version of the golden calf story, one that reverses its movement from anger to violent action. In Freud's reading, Moses' wrath culminates not in the discharge, but in the mastery of his rage. The strange bodily posture and expression of Michelangelo's Moses is portraying not the imminent smashing of the tablets, but the agitated bodily stance of someone who has at once felt and overcome his wrath, who chooses to refrain from smashing the tablets and punishing his people. This, writes Freud, is an exemplary Renaissance Moses, embodying a new and powerful emotional self-discipline. The giant frame, with its tremendous physical power, becomes only a concrete expression of the highest mental achievement that is possible in man, that of struggling successfully against an inward passion for the sake of a cause to which he has devoted himself. This sublime mental achievement complicates the sequential relationship between anger and aggression. Instead of anger being the signal that triggers an aggressive action, aggressive action is diverted toward a state of feeling. Instead of being discharged, the aggressive impulse is born in the psychic and bodily interior. The life of feeling, we might say, is a way of finding something to do with our emotions other than simply acting on them. In his earliest formulations of the means and ends of psychotherapy, Freud was heavily invested in what we might call the hydraulic thesis, according to which human beings accumulate large reserves of tension in everyday life, inducing a permanent pressure on the nervous system and a consequent demand for its release. In the context of psychoanalysis and its beginnings, this tension is commonly associated with the torrent of erotic desire and yearning which was heaving below the oppressively mannered surface of fin de siècle Viennese society. But in his early clinical practice, Freud was equally witness to frequent bottlenecks of anger and aggression in his patients. One such intriguing instance is related in a brief clinical vignette from the 1893 Preliminary Communication, co-written with his older colleague, Josef Breuer, a Viennese GP, in which the pair outline their therapeutic innovations in the treatment of hysteria. A man consults Freud at his newly established practice for the treatment of nervous disorders. He has been suffering from spontaneous, hysterical attacks, during which he falls into frenzies of wordless rage. Under hypnosis, he reveals that he's been living through the scene in which his employer had abused him in the street and hit him with a stick. Returning a few days later, the patient tells of a second attack, which is revealed under hypnosis to be a staging of the event that had triggered his illness, the scene in the law court when he failed to obtain satisfaction for his maltreatment. Freud and Breuer tell us almost nothing about the man. He might be a factory worker or a waiter, but I always imagine him in the mould of an emerging stock type, the pinched, anxious clerk, soon to be immortalised in Franz Kafka's Joseph K. or E.M. Forster's Leonard Bast, men whose apologetic facade conceals a quietly roiling anger and resentment. These iconic fictional figures fit the classical neurasthenic profile that Freud was beginning to treat and write about. A phenomenon of the rapidly urbanising, industrialising society of the late 19th century, neurasthenia was the consequence of a sudden and excessive load of sensory and emotional stimuli bearing down on mind and body, inducing symptoms of irritability, fatigue and depression, as well as headaches and spikes in blood pressure. The employee's silent pantomimic fury suggests a nervous system traumatized and overwhelmed, unable to bear the burden of humiliation induced by the public beating and the subsequent public repudiation of his legal case for compensation. Freud's clinical interest in the nervous afflictions of the moment was accompanied by more fundamental inquiries into psychic life, equally relevant to the case of the beaten employee. In an unpublished text of 1895, known as the Project for a Scientific Psychology, Freud speculates on the baby's earliest experience of satisfaction, describing a being beset by excess internal tension brought about by hunger or some other vital need. Unable to provide for herself, the baby cries, communicating her distress and drawing the attention of her caregiver. The circuit of tension, external intervention, and relief constitutes an experience of satisfaction. The efficacy of the baby's hungry scream leads Freud to the startling inference that the initial helplessness of human beings is the primal source of all moral motives. That is, morality begins in the distress of the creature who calls on her carers to provide satisfactions she cannot supply for herself. For as long as they fail to do so, she screams her angry proto-moral protest. The hypnosis of the beaten employee had revealed a similarly helpless scream, this time unvoiced, when he failed to obtain satisfaction for his maltreatment. The verbal echo is more than coincidence. The humiliating incapacity to gain satisfaction puts the employee in contact with his original infantile helplessness. His reaction, like the baby's, is a wordless scream of rage, now driven into the silence of unconscious memory. Hysteria, neurasthenia, infantile need. Underlying these very different psychic phenomena is the same experience of helplessness. The baby's scream announces a gap between a need and its satisfaction, which becomes harder to bear the longer it is sustained. Ordinarily, our physical and emotional development removes us from this state of helplessness. As we grow in mental and bodily autonomy, we are able increasingly to help ourselves, to seek and find the food or love we crave. But as the beaten employee's case reminds us, an experience of traumatic shock or humiliation can revive in us the desperate vulnerability of the infant. And as my psychoanalytic practice reminds me each day, even our much more ordinary experiences, real or perceived insults, slights, rejections, disappointments, frustrations, can bring us into contact with this primary layer of helplessness. Our persistent failures to remedy the insistent dissatisfactions of daily life gives rise to that state of agitated enervation we call anger. A hungry baby's cry is angry, an expression of raw physical and emotional need. But it is also a rudimentary form of aggression, what Freud calls a specific action, aimed at achieving real-world satisfaction. In his writings, stretching from the 1930s to the 1970s, D.W. Winnicott, the British paediatrician and psychoanalyst, transformed our understanding of how the management of infantile needs shapes our subsequent development. He notes that the newborn infant has gestated in an environment in which all his needs have been satisfied before he could even become aware of them as needs. Expelled from the mother's body, exposed to the cold infinity of the new space around him, subjected to delay between hunger and feeding, the baby is made suddenly aware of himself as one who can lack what he needs. According to Winnicott, the baby manages these traumatic intimations of a world of things and people outside himself by forging an illusion of his omnipotent control over it. When he cries, he causes the breast and its abundant supply of milk and love to appear. In the first weeks of life, at least, his mother will be inclined to nurture this illusion by feeding and tending to her baby on demand. His total helplessness is thus inverted, such that every voice, every touch, every sensual emanation of the world around him becomes a projection of his own desire. It is, as the saying goes, his world. We just live in it. The central task of development is the gradual and gentle dispelling of this illusion and the concomitant acknowledgement of what Winnicott calls not-me objects. A reckoning with a world of more than just one, in which the growing child must make room for others. And this is where the problems start, where his appetites for love, pleasure, and power run up against the failure or incapacity or unwillingness of others to satisfy them, not to mention the scandalizing existence of the same appetites in others. The lesson the child learns, in other words, is that his aggressive bids for one satisfaction or another are liable to fail, and that he is bound to carry the remnants of those failures within himself. When we describe a person's character as angry, we're saying that the weight of that burden is too heavy for them to bear. The other lesson he learns, no less bitter but ultimately perhaps more productive, is that dissatisfaction, and by extension a certain quantum of anger, is endemic to living. This is why the hydraulic thesis, on which Freud based his abreactive technique for treatment, is fatally flawed. Under hypnosis, the beaten employee acted out the silent rage he had been forced to suppress, both in the street and in the court. The abreactive technique works on the premise that as the repressed memory rises to the surface of consciousness, so does its companion emotion, enabling the patient to describe the distressing experience and the feelings it aroused as fully as possible. This is the psychotherapy of energetic reaction, which demands a release of emotion proportionate to the injury suffered. It is a technique whose rationale is implied in such idiomatic phrases as crying oneself out or blowing off steam. The German is sich austoben, literally to rage oneself out, as well as in folk anger management techniques such as pillow bashing. Without hydraulic release, Freud posited, the distress and anger felt by the victim remains an ongoing burden on the nervous system. The idea of a treatment directed at unmetabolized pain lodged in the deepest strata of mind and body has been revived in various therapies, most famously in Arthur Yanov's primal therapy, popularly known as primal scream therapy, which enjoyed a brief vogue in the early 1970s. Like Freud and Breuer, Yanov saw psychic pain as located in suppressed traumas of early childhood. The proposed cure was to discharge the trapped reactive anger in uninhibited and spontaneous screaming and ranting. The practice has occasionally been revived over the last 15 years or so in the form of rage rooms, rented spaces in which customers wearing protective gear take metal poles to breakable objects, defunct electronic appliances, unwanted crockery, disused furniture, in an extended ritual of frenzied destruction, which, as documented by Guardian writer Gabby Hinsliff, has become increasingly popular with young women as a hybrid health and leisure activity. The problem with such cathartic extravagances is that they misrecognize the nature of rage. Abreaction assumes a setup in which feelings are stored in finite quantities to be cried out to the point of full discharge. But as he developed his thinking and gained clinical experience, Freud came to see his belief in abreaction as a mistake, albeit a productive one. What it misses is the dogged persistence of feelings, their stubborn refusal to disappear on demand. The screams of the baby or the traumatized adult register a state of dissatisfaction, a gap between a need or desire, hunger, love, justice, and its fulfillment. But dissatisfaction is not simply a temporary state awaiting relief through appropriate action. It is an illimitable condition of human life, and so therefore is anger. The failure of the cathartic method ultimately comes down to the nature of human drives, one of the most basic but equally most enigmatic elements in psychoanalysis. In his definitive statement on the subject, his 1915 paper, Drives and Their Vicissitudes, Freud notes, first of all, that a drive is a source of stimulus from within the organism, not outside it. The difference is crucial in that the impact of an external stimulus, say a bright light or loud noise, is always temporary. The stimulus exerted by a drive, on the other hand, is always a constant one, and because it issues from within, there is no escaping it. Drives aim at satisfaction through the attainment of an aim. From the beginning of life, they teach us to love what satisfies us, the breast that feeds, the voice that soothes, the hands that hold us, and hate what frustrates us, hunger, inattention. These impulses are forever exerting themselves, calling on us, driving us, to obtain more of what we need and want. A drive, Freud writes, lies on the frontier between the mental and the somatic. It is the psychic representative of a bodily stimulus, what an itch might look like if it were a mental rather than dermal entity. Freud ascribes four components to a drive: pressure, the force it exerts in making its demand on us; aim, which Freud identifies as being in every instance satisfaction; object, the thing required to achieve satisfaction, a breast, a touch, a voice; and source, the somatic location in which the drive originates, stomach, head, genital. In concert, these four factors give rise to a predicament. The passage from the pressure of the drive to its satisfaction cannot be straight. Put simply, to be under pressure of the drive is to want something without knowing exactly what that something is. This distinguishes the drive from the more straightforwardly biological concept of an instinct. An instinct is a mechanism at work in all life forms, such as the bee's gravitation towards honey and nectar, which ensures the attainment of vital needs. We might say that the newborn baby's rooting for the mother's breast is of the same nature, but the comparison would be both correct and incomplete. The French psychoanalyst Jean Laplanche points out that from the very beginning of life, our vital needs are inextricably tied up with our sexuality. Not, of course, the genital sexuality of adulthood, but the sensual currents of tenderness and affection emanating from the mother's body. A breast feeds and fills the baby's hungry stomach, but also provides the more elusive pleasures that arise from the smell and feel of his mother's skin, the flood of abundant warmth that breaks over his lips with the flow of milk. The aim and object of a drive, therefore, are both subject to infinite variation. Life almost never involves knowing what we want and getting it. The demands of the drive, Freud says, can be inhibited or deflected, diverted from the path they started down. Anyone who has spent significant time around a baby knows how frequently and frustratingly they can fail to be satisfied by, well, anything. How tormented they can seem by not knowing what they want, or perhaps by not having the means to tell us. And anyone who has spent significant time around an adult, themselves included, knows how insistently this torment persists through the course of life. All those regions of life that arouse our deepest longings and desires, love, work, food, money, rest, meaning, are also those that arouse the most painful feelings of uncertainty and self-division. The aggressive drive impels us to get what we want, but so often leaves us with the feeling that what we got wasn't quite what we wanted, if indeed we got it at all. We then cast around for something or someone to blame for this feeling, for standing in the way of the true fulfillment of our desire. We may try to tell ourselves that the one thing that eluded us, a longed-for birthday gift or lover or promotion, was the difference between happiness and misery. Freud sees this malaise as rooted in the nature of childhood love, a first characteristic of which, as he writes in his 1931 essay Female Sexuality, is its boundlessness. A second, more surprising feature is that it has, in point of fact, no aim and is incapable of obtaining complete satisfaction, and principally for that reason, it is doomed to end in disappointment and to give place to a hostile attitude. The aimlessness of the drive to love is destined to end in rage. This is the source of the complaint commonly heard in the consulting room, he goes on to say. that the patient's mother did not give her enough milk, did not suckle her long enough. Freud initially offers a cultural explanation for this complaint, noting that in the highly regulated monogamous family of the modern West, breastfeeding tends not to last beyond 6 to 9 months, where in traditional societies it is more likely to continue for 2 to 3 years. But no sooner does he advance this theory than he rejects it, suggesting that the more likely explanation is the greed of a child's libido renders her likely to make the same complaint regardless of the length of her suckling period. The twin hungers for food and love become indistinguishable and eventually a major source of eating disorders. Unable to regulate her appetite for love, the child instead brings her appetite for food under tyrannical control. Failure is endemic to the drive's quest to know what it wants and to obtain it. But another way to be governed by the drive is to be angry at two levels: the emotional level of the infant, who discharges her anger in screams, and later at the feeling level of the older person, child, adolescent, adult, who can experience and elaborate her anger. The theogonies and mythologies of the ancient world, from Canaan to Greece, India to Iceland, abound with avatars of pure rage. Think of the Erinnyes, the spirits of unbounded fury who hound the matricidal Orestes, or of Lyssa, the goddess of rage who afflicts her victims with irremediable rabid frenzies. Hindu theogony tells of the goddess Kali, decorated with a garland of arms and weapons and a necklace of decapitated heads, springing from the body of Durga, when the latter was assailed by demons, a terrifying embodiment of avenging rage. As represented in these figures, rage is less a feature of individual human psychology than an elemental force of the cosmos, unleashing limitless destruction on the world. From early childhood, I was aware of this force presiding over the Hebrew scriptures. Stupefied by the long Sabbath morning service, I would read a children's Bible, often turning to the story of the flood. The telling of the story in sermons and Sunday morning classes would place all the emphasis on God's merciful preservation of a future human race, the ark, the dove, the rainbow, skating over his more obviously destructive role in the story. God enjoins Noah to build the ark, which will preserve him, his family, and his animals from the flood he will soon be visiting on the earth to put an end to all flesh. God is grieved at heart by his own error in creating a race so irredeemably corrupt. "I will blot out man, whom I created from the face of the earth, man and beast and creeping things and birds of the air, for I regret that I made them." I remember the feeling of dismayed confusion I had on first reading these lines. Why punish the animals along with the people? What had they done? And what about all the kids? Could it really be that just one family merited saving? My mind's eye was assailed by the image of my own frenziedly waving hand rapidly disappearing beneath the rising floodwaters. But more frightening still than the wholesale drowning of life on earth was the image of a god who could erase the world he'd created as casually as a draftsman rubbing out a pencil sketch. This god was nothing like a furious parent or stern teacher administering slaps or confiscations or issuing dire warnings, but a power of pure annihilation hovering menacingly over all existence. The relief I felt on reading God's post-diluvian resolution to never again destroy all living beings was fleeting. While there was to be no reprise of the watery apocalypse, the divine urge to liquidate the sinners didn't abate. Soon after the flood came God's announcement to Abraham that the sheer gravity of sin in the towns of Sodom and Gomorrah left him with no choice but to wipe them out. Unlike Noah, who declines to plead humanity's case, Abraham intercedes on behalf of Sodom and Gomorrah, winning God's concession that should 50 righteous men be found in them, he will spare the towns. Abraham then bargains God down in small increments to just 10. But the negotiations come to nothing. The Lord caused to rain upon Sodom and upon Gomorrah brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. The Pentateuch doesn't let up in its record of God's punitive exterminations, reaching something of a peak in the book of Numbers. When God sends 12 spies from the wilderness to spy out the land of Canaan, the future inheritance of the people of Israel, 10 of them return and spread an evil report of the territory, warning that it teems with the menace of enemy warrior tribes. Furious at hearing his promised land thus spurned, God resolves to send a plague to destroy the people. This time, it's Moses that intercedes on Israel's behalf, persuading God to refrain from total annihilation. But he cannot prevent God from visiting a deadly plague against the trash-talking spies and their followers, nor can his dire warnings help the Israelites, who return to the top of the mountain in penance, only to die by the Amalekite sword, unprotected by the God who, with grisly irony, abandons them to slaughter by the very enemies they had warned against. The book of Numbers goes on to tell of Korah's rebellion against Moses' God-given authority, which ends when Korah and his company, along with their wives and children, are swallowed by a mouth that opened and sealed them in the earth. The cumulative effect of these purgative visitations is to build a picture of God's anger as instantaneous justice, a kind of divine red mist that short-circuits any pause for reflection. Only the interventions of his chosen prophets can stay the scope and force of his unbound punitive rage, and even then only within strict limits. Water, fire and earth, pestilence and the sword, the elements of nature, both non-human and human, become instruments of an educative divine terror, a fury so immediately realized in lethal consequences it can seem as though God's feelings are indistinguishable from his actions. Is this not the ultimate model for the vengeful fantasies aroused by our own furies? I can vividly recall, several years before I'd read any Bible stories, the shoves and slaps of other kids in the kindergarten sandbox stirring me to visions of their instant mass combustion, triggered by the raised tip of my index finger. To carry my anger within felt humiliating, a smarting body memory of injury and defeat. I wanted to consummate it in some magic act of aggression, one that would leave behind no trace of itself, as though my anger would be burnt out in perfect synchrony with the bodies of my enemies. About 30 years later, walking down a busy street on a London winter night, I felt a hard slap on the back of my head, sending the peaked cap I was wearing to the pavement. Reeling from the shock, the words, "fucking wanker," resounding in my ears, I saw the fast-receding back of my assailant, his bald skull perched atop the folds of an obscenely thick neck. Feeling the dull ache of shame as I picked up the hat, I shut my eyes and saw my fingers on the back of that neck, plunging his ruddy bowling ball of a head into a bowl of nitric acid. Rarely have I more vividly understood the annihilating wrath of God, not to mention the impotent rage of a wounded man. What continues to trouble me about Abraham's bargaining with God is the suspicion that it's no more than a ritual dance, the two of them playing out the moves in the mutual knowledge that it makes no difference, that the incineration of Sodom, Gomorrah and its people, like all of the subsequent divine punishments of the Pentateuch, has already been decreed and is merely awaiting execution. This only renders more intriguing the presentation of God's anger in the book of Jonah, dated somewhere between 2 and 4 centuries after most scholars date the completion of the Pentateuch. The book of Jonah begins with God appearing to the reluctant prophet, commanding him to go to Nineveh and proclaim against its spreading wickedness. Jonah's defiant response is to flee unto Tarshish from the presence of the Lord, triggering his protracted and strange pursuit by God. Strange, because Jonah is aware throughout that God's presence is looming over him for the entire chase. God sends the storms that threaten to wreck the ship on which he escapes, and the whale in whose belly he resides 3 days and nights until he is vomited onto shore. Jonah doesn't resist God's second command to go to Nineveh, where he soon arrives and warns its people of its divine overthrow 40 days hence. On hearing Jonah's prophecy, the king of Nineveh dons sackcloth and ashes and ordains a citywide fast as a penance. Seeing the people's repentance, God turns away his fierce anger. This is Jonah's cue to become exceedingly angry, telling God that this is exactly why he fled from him in the first place. "For I knew that thou art a gracious God and compassionate and long-suffering and abundant in mercy and repentest thee of evil." In other words, he knew his prophecy of the city's destruction wouldn't be realized, which makes him look more like a ranting fool than a prophet. This is the wretched humiliation he was fleeing from, and that now leaves him feeling, "It is better for me to die than to live." "Art thou greatly angry?" God asks him. to which the book records no response. Jonah wanders to the east of the city to find rest in a booth. God has a gourd rise from the ground and cast sufficient shadow to protect Jonah from the heat. But as morning comes, he sends a worm to chew through the gourd, exposing Jonah to the full heat of the sun and causing him to repeat his earlier conviction, "It is better for me to die than to live." "Are you greatly angry for the gourd?" God asks him, evoking a mother soothing her inconsolable toddler. "I am greatly angry, even unto death," Jonah replies. God's homily gives the diminutive book its climactic and wonderfully anticlimactic words. "Thou hast had pity on the gourd, for which thou hast not laboured, neither madest it grow, which came up in a night and perished in a night. And should I not have pity on Nineveh, that great city, wherein are more than 60,000 persons that cannot discern between their right hand and their left hand, and also much cattle?" What on earth, or in heaven, has happened to God across the centuries between Noah's flood and Jonah's gourd? Contrast the way Abraham gingerly tiptoes around God's rage and appealing for mercy with Jonah's indignation at God's mercy, the complete destruction Abraham seeks hopelessly to prevent, with the complete destruction Jonah seeks hopelessly to bring about. It is hard to avoid the impression of a peculiar reversal in the interim, whereby Jonah has acquired something of God's annihilating fury, and God has acquired something of Abraham's merciful empathy. Where Jonah has raised his mind to the great throne of divine judgment, God seems to have descended into the messy throng of humankind. What so moves me about God's climactic words is that they ask the very questions I asked of my children's Bible. But are they really that bad? And what have the cows done for God's sake? You do realize there are a lot of cows in this place. I mean, did you even think about the cows, Jonah? Seen up close, the people of Nineveh appear to God as less evil than morally hapless, no less flailing and lost than the rest of us. It's not that God's anger has abated, but that it seems to have lost its terrifying aura of finality. The fury of Noah's God exerted a pressure that could only find release in the watery extinction of humankind. It required an action fully commensurate with its absolute force. It is an anger of almost platonic purity, free of any corrupting ambiguity or self-doubt. It strikes me that the divine anger of the flood might serve as a tacit model, or at least an inspiration, for Twitter anger, for the indignant summary judgments so memorably documented by John Ronson in So You've Been Publicly Shamed, with which social media posters shame, belittle, and damn the objects of their moral and political displeasure. Viewing the offenders from such a transcendent height ensures they are mere specks in the poster's field of vision, as easy to incinerate as an ant under a sunstruck magnifying glass. God seems no less enraged with the Ninevites than with the denizens of the antediluvian world, but their repentance, assumed with the immediate, zealous remorse of the scalded child, induces in God a previously unsuspected empathy. In a sense, he becomes as confused as they are, shuttling abruptly from divine exterminator to exasperatedly loving father, at a loss for what to do with these wayward, hapless souls he's created. Perhaps Jonah doesn't get it because he, unlike God, is childless. "You really expect me to kill all these poor chumps? Come on, Jonah, what kind of monster do you take me for? They're just dumb kids." Isn't this much closer to the anger vented on next door? Not the anger of summary judgment from on high, but the frustrated rage of human beings consigned to dwell in the world below, a world of infinite other human beings who get on your fucking nerves with their insistence on doing stuff you really don't like. This second type of anger, the anger of frustrated rage, is the one we meet most frequently in our everyday life. But the first type, the summary judgment of God or the gods, cannot be consigned to the ancient past. It may be a mythic ideal, but mythic ideals can often be a real force in the world. So much of the anger that circulates between individuals and groups is tacitly conditioned by the fantasy of a divine rage, in which the chaos of angry feelings would be redeemed in a single, perfectly cathartic action. In fact, it's this fantasy that can make anger feel so unpleasantly enervating. The desperate urge, so frequently heard in my consulting room, to liquidate the object of rage tends only to exacerbate our feelings of injury and humiliation when it turns out to be impracticable. This predicament is dramatized in the opening of the inaugural work of Western literature. The first word of the Iliad, Homer's epic poem of the dying phases of the Trojan War, is menin, variously translated as wrath, anger, rage, fury. Where thymos, the other word Homer uses to signify anger, is closer to passion or spiritedness, menin suggests a more explicitly destructive emotion. The opening lines invite the muse to sing the menin, the accusative form of menis, which the next line augments as oleumenin, the accursed anger of Achilles, whose force hurled the souls of so many Greek warriors down to Hades. It goes on to recount the quarrel of Achilles with Agamemnon, the implacably arrogant warrior king, who, in the 10th year of the Trojan War, brings calamity on his army. Agamemnon has captured Chryseis, daughter of the elderly Trojan priest Chrysis, for a concubine. Chrysis entreats Agamemnon to return her to him and is brutally refused. The distressed priest entreats the god Apollo to vengeance against the Greeks and is duly obliged. After Apollo fells columns of Greek soldiers with lethal arrows, their commanders gather for crisis talks. Achilles leads a chorus of demands for Agamemnon to return Chryseis. Impelled by narcissistic injury and envious spite, Agamemnon agrees on condition he is compensated by a prize of equal worth, Achilles' concubine, Briseis. The enraged Achilles reaches for a sword to slay the king, only to be held back by the goddess Athene. Prevented from unleashing his fury, Achilles consents bitterly to the trade-off. Forced to bear the pressure of the menace he cannot act upon, he exacts the heaviest of prices from Agamemnon and the Greeks. Achilles, their great defence against the horror of war, will withdraw himself from fighting, exposing his fellow warriors to the worst peril. Perhaps no work of literature since Homer's has chronicled more vividly this inexorable descent from indignation to accursed anger, oleumenin, anger that feeds off itself, becoming ever more impervious to appeasement or repair. All efforts to bring Achilles' rage under the rule of reason and proportion prove hopeless. When the warrior Aias reproaches him during the failed mission to persuade him to join the battle against the Trojans for the savagery in his breast and lack of thought for the love of his companions, Achilles doesn't deny the charge. "All that you have said seems much after my own feeling." But, he goes on, "my heart swells with anger whenever I think of that time, how the son of Atreus treated me with contempt in front of the Argives." In Achilles, we witness the annihilating wrath of the god of Abraham running up against the limits imposed by the human world. He can't deny that his grievance has come to be infected with all the vindictive spite he condemned in Agamemnon. But his self-awareness does nothing to salve the wound of being humiliated before his companion warriors. Stoked by the self-propelling force of the aggressive drive, his anger has taken on a life of its own, over which he himself seems to feel he has little command. Though he acknowledges its disproportion to Aias, it continues to swell his heart regardless. The German philosopher Peter Sloterdijk argues that rage has both shaped and derailed the course of Western history precisely through its refusal of any logic of balance and proportion. With Achilles in mind, he observes that the West's cherished remedies for bringing to a halt the endless pendulum of hit and retaliation, from private spiritual exercises to public justice to foreign policy, are liable to run up against their own limits. Just as a festering wound can become both a chronic and general malady, psychic and moral wounds also may not heal, which creates its own corrupt temporality, the infinity of an unanswered complaint. Imagine a world in which our psychic and moral wounds could always find remedy in appropriate action, in which we knew just what was needed to relieve our dissatisfactions. In such a world, we'd never have to carry the burden of anger for long. Feeling angry would simply be the fleeting signal to do whatever the situation required, be it signing a petition or blowing up a building. Complaints would always be answered, wounds would always heal. The problem is that action never exhausts feeling. Moreover, Sloterdijk suggests, this gap between the rage inside us and the aggression that externalizes it can very easily become a chasm. Aggression is a drive, and it is in the nature of the drive, Freud says, never to achieve full satisfaction. We may enjoy the passing sense that a given action has blown off enough steam or raged us out, but anger has a strange habit of regenerating itself. This is how a historical wound to an individual or group is always liable to shade into the infinity of an unanswered complaint. One of the key distinctions Sloterdijk makes in rage and time is between what he calls banked and dispersed rage. The popular revolutionary leaders of previous generations achieved power by harnessing and banking the rage of the humiliated and offended victims of political and economic injustice and oppression across generations. In doing so, they sought to gather the mass of anger into a rage bank that could power a long-term transformation of society. A dispersed rage, in contrast, is one which is lacking a shared project in which to invest itself. This is the rage that has come to be so vulnerable to exploitation and manipulation by cynical or extremist forces, from far-right populism to jihadism. We can find an analogue for this distinction in individual psychology. A person's emotional life can be defined by a sense of integration and organization, or on the contrary, by a sense of dispersion and incoherence. In his 1949 paper, Mind and Its Relation to Psyche Soma, Winnicott suggests that the way we experience our feelings has its roots in our developmental experience of our bodies. Under conditions of what Winnicott calls good enough care, a baby will be in perpetual contact with the ongoing life of her body, the rhythm of her breathing, the ever-renewed sensations at the surface of the skin, the undirected movement of the limbs, the curious emanations of the voice, the secretions and excretions flowing from every orifice. The immersion in her own bodily life is the basis for the development of a psyche, which, in the first instance, writes Winnicott, means the imaginative elaboration of somatic parts, feelings and functions, that is, of physical aliveness. We are very close here to Damasio's understanding of feelings as the interior mapping of emotions. It is this psychic dialogue with our own body that is felt by the individual to form the core for the imagination. The possibility of creative life begins in the fullness of bodily life. We might say, using Sloterdijk's terminology, that in healthy development, the psyche gathers or banks bodily experience for its own nourishment and transformation. This ordinary yet inestimable human achievement rests on continuity of being, which allows a baby to grow and change undisturbed at her own pace. Whereas when the baby's bodily expression and freedom are constrained by a demand for compliance, for example, when she is put under pressure to sleep or remain quiet or acquire cognitive skills very early, she is at risk of forming a pathological mind psyche rather than a healthy psyche soma. A mind psyche experiences the body as an alien entity and so cannot feel fully alive. Instead of being concentrated, emotional life feels fragmented and scattered. The experience of the world feels eerily disembodied, the range and freedom of the imagination acutely constrained. In clinical work with patients of this kind, Winnicott suggests, an awareness will likely emerge of a gap in the continuity of their own selfhood. In one of his patients, the awareness that she has been, as it were, trapped in her head all her life, leads to an enraged assault on her own skull, in which violent head banging appeared as an attempt to produce a blackout. It is as though the head is suddenly perceived as a kind of thief of life that must be destroyed before it can be endowed with a new life within the body. Without psychosomatic elaboration, emotional experience is impoverished. The New Zealand-born French psychoanalyst Joyce McDougall observed this impoverishment in the ways some of her patients seemed unable to feel their emotional responses, needing instead to be constantly engaged in immediately dispersing in action whatever impacted them emotionally. The predicament of such patients is that they cannot find a path to their own psychosomatic life and so cannot begin to find the images or words to encompass what they're feeling. As with Winnicott's head-banging patient, this is likely to have the effect of inducing an irremediable state of rage and a permanent sense of feeling empty, misunderstood, or out of touch with others, often expressing itself in the overpowering need for medication, food, tobacco, alcohol, opiates, and frantic sexual exploits of a perverse or compulsive nature. This description of dispersed inner life starts to get at the nature of our enervated and angry societies. We live under conditions of what we might call malign public care. Governments that manipulate information, welfare budgets, democratic institutions and class differences to foment division, fear and mistrust between native citizens and migrants, leavers and remainers, red and blue states, workers and shirkers, internet and TV news media that distort, deny and invent facts in order to stoke the rage of their viewers and listeners, big tech corporations that place us under permanent surveillance and harness our private data to shape our own private lives. Like Winnicott's overbearing parents, these modes of governance and communication at once demand our compliance and infuse our relationships to ourselves and others with anxiety and confusion. What the psychosomatic patient McDougall describes as feeling empty, misunderstood, or out of touch with others starts to sound eerily like any of us living in today's advanced societies. The pervasive use of antidepressant and anxiolytic medication may not be very surprising. Addressing the permanent state of physical and psychic vulnerability experienced by so many, the political theorist and writer William Davis points to various forms of violence, from terrorism to computer hacking and trolling, that cast their shadow on our everyday lives. The effect of these latter virtual forms of intrusion and attack may be primarily psychological, writes Davis in Nervous States, but their effect can undoubtedly be called violent. What it damages are the feelings of security and trust that allow diverse societies to function, and it replaces them with nervousness. Once nervousness becomes the dominant mood of society, anger is given license to spread and grow. The pathological insecurity and mistrust that tormented Winnicott's and McDougall's patients seem to have become dominant features of our everyday lives. Winnicott's head-banging patient, trapped in the alienated, fragmented mind psyche she seeks desperately to break open, is a powerful cipher of our citizens of the virtual world, trapped in informational bubbles that violently circumscribe our emotional and imaginative freedom, creating conditions in which disagreement and difference breed not curiosity and exchange, but enmity and mutual cancellation from inside a self-confirming echo chamber. It's from this soil that the abstracted, grandiose anger of social media warriors grows, the anger of countless nervous mind psyches desperately trying to cancel out their own felt vulnerabilities and doubts, to brandish a clarity and certainty they crave but can never really achieve. The epidemics of self-harm, eating disorders, and opioid addictions blighting the lives of so many individuals and communities today are further symptoms of the spreading nervousness tracked by Davis. In such malaises, the malign care internalized by Winnicott's and McDougall's patients seems to spread to the life of our disintegrated and agitated society. Readers will notice that I seem to use the words anger and rage interchangeably. This is deliberate, in spite of my awareness that the two words signify quite different meanings. In discussions of anger with psychoanalytic colleagues, they've often appealed to this distinction, arguing that anger is a structured, integral feeling under the self's control, where rage is a kind of psychic and bodily dispossession, closer to madness. While this distinction has pragmatic value, I think it is ultimately an artificial one that assumes anger can be brought under the command of the ego. Once we recognize that anger is never fully under our command, that at the moment we imagine we are in possession of it, it takes possession of us, rage becomes a possibility lurking inside anger rather than a feeling distinct from it. In what follows, we'll explore the rage engendered by this collective agitation, which I divide into four broad types. We start with the split, paranoid politics engendered by the unshakable conviction of one's own rightness, which I refer to as righteous rage. To be right, as Anthony Trollope shows us so vividly in his 1869 novel He Knew He Was Right, is to insulate oneself in advance from the risks and vulnerabilities of doubt and take refuge in the precarious comfort of one's own certainty. Lurking in this state of mind is a fantasy of anger that can be fulfilled and discharged in some ultimately purgative act of aggression. The problem with such fantasies is that they fail, which leads us to the second form of anger. What I call failed rage is simply anger's failure to realize itself in action, and the consequent experience of being abandoned to an anger that has nowhere to go. This often leads to a resolution, which might be embodied in a culture or a religious movement, to renounce anger altogether. The problem with this renunciation is that rather than expunging anger from individual and collective life, it tends to engender forms of rage which deny, disguise, and displace themselves. The loudly proclaimed gospels of positive thinking, for example, or the much more subterranean strategies of passive aggression. When anger is frustrated, it quickly becomes vulnerable to emotional and political manipulation and exploitation. This possibility gives rise to a third kind of anger, cynical rage. One place this can be stoked very damagingly is in the psychotherapeutic consulting room. The key instrument of psychoanalytic therapy is transference, the patient's necessary and unconscious misrecognitions of their analyst as iterations of formative figures of their past, parents or teachers, for example. If the analyst understands the mechanism of transference, they can also manipulate the patient by exploiting the rawest and most vulnerable spots of their inner life. What can this egregious form of intimate manipulation tell us about the forms of political manipulation that are driving and shaping so much of our present-day politics, particularly in the form of strongman leaders and the cults that form around them? What makes the anger that drove Brexit and the election of Trump or Russia's war on Ukraine or the tragic exchanges of terror and asymmetrical warfare in Israel and Palestine so dangerous, if not its dogged commitment never to question or examine itself? We assume we are right so as to evade the risks of others or even our own curiosity, questioning or doubt. So often, debate about these essential issues becomes a kind of hostile informational warfare, the empty rehearsal of talking points from which the pain or value of the other has already been discounted. If anger could be a means of fostering love and justice rather than closing it down, it would need to start from an embrace rather than a denial of one's own vulnerability and self-doubt, along with a real curiosity about the other, not excluding what might be making them angry. Only at this point, I suggest, will rage become usable. My hope is that this book can arouse that curiosity and open discussion around why this terrible and necessary force drives our world, and how we can learn to live with it.